Before the sun set that evening, Neir filled his canteen, tucked a prayer rug beneath his arm, and climbed the south-facing dune near the camp. Behind him came a burst of loud laughter from one of the tents, and he imagined that his men were playing cards and passing the siddiqui around. Years of travelling in the desert had taught him that it was impossible to stop people from doing whatever they liked. There was no law out here, and if the men wanted alcohol, they would drink. It disgusted Neir that they would wake up on Friday morning, the holy day, their bodies fouled with gin. But he said nothing. After 10 days of fruitless searching, he was not in the mood to chastise. He scaled the dune at an easy pace, stopping only once he'd reached the crest. From here, he had a sprawling view of the desert valley, crisp and flat, surrounded by low dunes that undulated in the golden colour of sunset. But his eye was drawn to the blot on the landscape. Half a dozen vultures hunched over a jackal's carcass. It was the reason they'd stopped here. Another false lead. Taking his compass from his pocket, he found the direction of Mecca and pointed his prayer rug there. Standing above the rug, he began to pray, but his thoughts kept on turning to Nuf. The more he thought about her, the more vivid she became. In his mind, she was walking through the desert, leaning into the wind, black cloak whipping against her sunburned ankles. Allah, forgive me for imagining her ankles, he thought. And then, at least I think she's still alive. His thoughts turned to the picture in his pocket. Checking to see that no one was coming up the hill behind, he took the picture out and allowed himself the rare indulgence of studying a woman's face. Nuf Ashrawi stood in the centre of the frame, smiling happily as she cut a slice of cake at her younger sister's birthday party. She had a long nose, black eyes, and a gorgeous smile. It was hard to imagine that just 4 weeks after the picture was taken, she had run away, to the desert, no less, leaving everything behind. A fiancé, a luxurious life, and a large, happy family. Why? He wondered. Nuf was only 16. When Othman had phoned and told him about his sister's disappearance, he had sounded weaker than Neir had ever heard him. I'd give my blood, he stammered, if that would help find her. In the long silence that followed, Neir knew he was crying. He'd heard the choke in his voice. Othman had never asked for anything before. Neir said he would assist. For many years he had taken the Sharawi men to the desert. In fact, he'd taken dozens of families just like the Sharawis, and they were all the same, rich and pompous. Desperate to prove that they hadn't lost their Bedouin birthright, even though, for most of them, the country's dark wells of petroleum would always be more compelling than its landscape. Othman was different. He was one of the few men who loved the desert as much as Neir. He didn't get sunburn, didn't get lost. Drawn together by a mutual love of the desert, he and Neir had fallen into an easy friendship that had deepened over the years. On the telephone, Othman was so distraught that the story came out in confusing fragments. His sister was gone. She had run away. Maybe she'd been kidnapped. Neir had to pry to get the facts. No one knew exactly when she had left. They only noticed she was missing in the late afternoon. She had told her mother she was going to the mall to exchange a pair of shoes. But by evening, the family had discovered that other things were gone too. A pickup truck, the new black cloak she was saving for the honeymoon. When they realized that a camel was missing from the stables, they decided she'd run away to the desert. Her disappearance had taken everyone by surprise. She was happy, Othman said. She was about to get married. If there was more to the story, Othman wasn't saying. Behind him came a shout. Neir grabbed his rug and canteen and scrambled down the dune. Someone was coming, and a desperate foreboding told him it was bad news. He jogged along the bottom of the dune and waited as the rover drove into the camp. Naya didn't recognize the young man at the wheel. He welcomed the guest and extended his hand. The boy introduced himself as Ibrahim Suleiman, a son of one of the Sharawi servants. "They found her," he said, his eyes lowered. "Who found her?" "We're not sure. Someone who wasn't working for the family. Travelers. They took her back to Jeddah. She was already dead."
"Dead?"
"Yes. They took her to the coroner's office in Jeddah. They had no idea who she was." "It was over. Do you know how she died?"
"No."
There was a sad acceptance in the boy's eyes. "Heat stroke, I imagine." "It's a terrible way to die," Naya said. Dank and grubby, Rawashin Alley could not have less resembled a depot of paradise, a way station for bodies on their way to Allah. Yet the coroner's building was there, tucked between two ugly office buildings and looking rather like a cousin of both. After the nuclear white of the day, the darkness was sudden and total. Once his eyes adjusted, he saw a security guard reading at his desk. "I'm here to pick up a body." He fished in his pocket for the official release form he'd received from one of the Sharawi servants that afternoon. The guard studied the paper carefully and handed it back. "She's down the hall," he said. Naya approached a pair of swing doors. When he opened them, the smell hit him like a slap. Ammonia, death, blood, and something else just as foul. Forcing a swallow, he thought he could taste sulfur from the brimstone that the Bedouin sometimes used to purify departing souls. "No," he thought, "that's my imagination." The room was sterile and bright. In the center stood a medical examiner bent over a body on the table. He looked up.
"Can I help you?" the examiner asked.
"I understand you have the girl who...
Are you family?"
"No, I'm not. No." He ran a hand down his face. "I'm here to pick up the body." The examiner dropped his scalpel in a silver tray and regarded Nair with frustration.
"We're not done with it. You're just going to have to wait."
Nair read the man's name tag. Abdullah Mamoun, medical examiner. He was just about to speak again when the door opened behind them and a woman entered the room. There would, of course, be female examiners to handle the female corpses. But seeing one in the flesh was a shock. She wore a white lab coat and a hijab, a black scarf on her hair. Because her face was exposed, he averted his gaze, blushing as he did so. Uncertain where to rest his eyes, he let them fall on the plastic ID tag that hung around her neck. Katya Hijazi, laboratory technician. He was surprised to see her first name on the tag. It should have been as private as her hair or the shape of her body, and it made her seem defiant. "Salaam alaikum, Dr. Mamoun," she said, approaching the examiner. Her voice was challenging. "You haven't been giving Mr. Sharkey a hard time, have you?" Naya hoped his confusion didn't show. How did she know his name? And what sort of woman wielded a strange man's name so confidently? Naya spoke to the examiner. "I have a jeep parked outside, but I'd like to identify the body before I leave with it." "All right," Miss Hijazi answered. Naya thought it was brazen of her to talk when she was not being spoken to. She led him to the metal table where Nuf's body lay and pulled the sheet from her face. "Poor girl. Her face was half charred from the sun, and the other half was ghastly grey. She must have been lying on her side for days. Miss Hijazi inspected Noof's head. Naya noticed something sticky in her hair just above the left ear. He turned to Mamoon and asked, "Is that blood?" Mamoon simply shrugged, while Miss Hijazi continued inspecting the wound. "Yes," she answered finally. "There's bruising. It looks like someone hit her pretty hard." "Was that wound the cause of death?"
"No," Mamoon said. "She drowned. A classic case. Foam in the mouth. Her lungs and stomach were filled with water."
The simplicity of drowning begged all sorts of questions. At least, when a woman drowns in the largest sand desert in the world, there ought to be an equally remarkable explanation. A silence ensued, and Miss Hijazi gently moved the sheet from Noof's arms. "There's something beneath her fingernails," she said. "These look like defensive wounds."
"No, no, no," Mamoon clucked, pushing her aside and pointing to one of Noof's wrists. "Those marks are from a camel's reins. Don't you see the pattern?"
She laid down the sheet.
"I see no evidence that she touched a camel.
No hairs on the body, no abrasions on her thighs."
"Here's what happened," Mamoon snapped. "She died when it rained. The wadis filled up. She was crossing the desert through one of those wadis, and shack, it started to rain. She tried to swim, but a flash flood carried her away. She banged her head. She hurt her wrists. She drowned."
Naya studied the examiner. "But she had a camel."
"So what?" he cried. "Camels can't swim."
"Camels swim," Naya said. "And the camel would have saved her life." "The best of women," the prophet said, "is the one who is pleasing to look at, who carries out your instructions when you ask her." The phrase ran through his mind as he pulled his jeep out of the cargo bay at the back of the building and took a left into traffic. Although the prophet was right, it seemed there was also a way of being righteous without being obedient. Naya couldn't be sure whether Miss Hijazi's boldness was in Noof's best interests, or whether it was carried out because of professional egotism, or because that was simply the sort of person she was. His instincts told him that the former was the case, and that she was guarding secrets for Noof's sake. Anyway, she was right about one thing. Defensive wounds, head trauma, drowning, no camel. It sounded strange. The camel part was especially troubling, because if he knew anything, he knew that no one lost a camel in the desert.